Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, and this is the 46 Fire American Soccer Show as we review the big quarterfinal victory by the USA women's team over the French 2-1. Megan Rapinoe once again with two big goals to put the USA ahead. And even though they pulled one back to the host nation, they were eliminated by Megan Rapinoe and the rest of the USA women's team. Joining me right now, Carter Krishnar from World Soccer Talk. We're going to wait for Miss Araceli Villanueva, who writes for MLSfemale.com. Carter, this was a huge win for the women. I mean, I think we all thought that the French were heavily favored in this one. It looked like shock and awe in the first minutes by the USA as Megan Rapinoe takes the free kick. I mean, I thought it got deflected off of somebody. I thought actually Megan Rapinoe was in the mixer, but she's the one that took the free kick. It went through at least five different French defenders, and the keeper caught it late. And then a big trailing goal by Rapinoe, who came in from an onside position as the cross was originally deflected, but it magically goes to Rapinoe, and she buries it to make it 2-0. They pull one back, but it didn't matter. The United States moves on to the semifinals.
Yeah, I wouldn't say the French were heavily favored because France has not won anything. So this group of players, the ones that play for Lyon, have won a lot at the club level, but France has this tendency in quarterfinals and semifinals of major tournaments to just blow apart. We saw that in the 2015 World Cup against Germany. We saw that in a match they controlled, but they didn't get the result. Germany beat them in penalties. And we saw that, obviously, in the Euros in 2017. Saw in the 2011 World Cup against the U.S. So they have they're very combustible. But we thought this time they were at home. But, you know, I could tell. Look, first off, I and many others questioned the decision to leave Lindsey Horan out of this team. Now, I understand Ertz and Mewis have been particularly good together in terms of their shape, their ability to play kind of as a double pivot, and their passing between one another throughout this tournament when they played together, and in the Spain game in particular, right, in the game where the U.S., quite frankly, I believe, and a lot of people disagree with it, I believe that was a much tougher game than today, other than the fact that France was at home. Spain were up for the challenge in the way that France wasn't. You could tell, though, even before the Rapinoe goal, I mean, I may have tweeted something in the third or fourth minute. Maybe I waited until the goal. Basically, France mentally, it's the same thing as usual. They're not at the races. They look scared. You look in the girls' eyes, they look scared. They look overawed. There was a real lack of creativity from France. Camille Abelet, who was their most creative player, retired last year. But look, I think what you're seeing in this match was just a really good shape from the U.S. back four and good play between Ertz and U.S. midfield. And, Daniel, I have to say, as the tournament has moved on, we've seen Crystal Dunn. I had a lot of question marks when she believes, and in those two friendlies back in January about her playing left back, but she's reading, she's cutting out passes well, long balls, long diagonal balls, that'll be important against England, and she's, while her passing isn't that crisp, her positioning sense has gotten much better. Her defensive instincts have gotten much, much better in the last 3 or 4 months. So she had a huge workload today, and she came through. So defensively outstanding and going forward, obviously some very good moments for us.
I think so too, and I think they absorbed a lot of pressure towards the back half of that first half for the women. I thought that while they weren't really creating enough chances, they held the pressure and withstood it from the French because I thought they were coming on. I thought they were trying to get everything. But the one thing that's really telling is that the French in the final third were not good enough. When you have zero shots on goal and you've had five shots in total in that first half, That says a lot, because when you have the women attacking, the French women attacking the U.S., just that final third was very, very lacking. I think at times you'd have to say that the U.S. women were lucky enough, because if they were able to get a shot on frame, you probably would say it'd be 1-1 at halftime, or at least maybe 2-1 France. But other than that, I thought they absorbed the pressure very well. I thought they defended very well, and they were just shots themselves, which I kind of disagreed with. But, you know, look, they held their own, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, Henri did not have a very good match in midfield based on her high standards, her lofty standards. Kane was kind of off. Lacemaire and Gavin didn't make the kind of runs I thought they'd make in that first half. And then they didn't come back to try and get service and maybe create situations where there were overloads, where U.S. defenders were put in tough positions and having to make decisions, having to make quick decisions when they're in tough positions defensively. That didn't happen. And, again, there was a certain timidity about France's play. There was a certain acceptance after the U.S. goal. That here we go again. This is Germany 2015. This is, you know, the same thing. And I think the thing that kept them in the match is the fact that the U.S. didn't get a second goal in the first half. I think that would have killed them psychologically. They were already down psychologically. And I know there were hyper critics that like to say, oh, France had all this possession. But I think if the U.S. doesn't get the second goal, Rapinoe doesn't get the second goal, the U.S. wins 1-0. France doesn't get that goal because, and by the way, when Horan came in, the U.S. played much better in terms of link-up play going forward. I think the U.S. sat a little deep, allowed Renard behind that line to get that goal, but it was 2-0 at that point. Did they seriously threaten again? Sort of. But I think there was only going to be one winner today. I think very clearly the U.S. were the better team mentally, fitness-wise. Their shape was better. They got everything right. I have to, apologize. You know, people who read me on Twitter, I know they realize how crazy I was going before the match with Horan out in the team and some of the things I was tweeting. I wasn't alone. And, you know, even tweeting, hey, it's been a half an hour. I've been pacing nervously after I was very confident that we would win this match because she left Lindsey Horan, who I consider to be the U.S.'s best technical player. And arguably, in my opinion, one of the top five players in the world, out of the team. But it worked out. Now, England, we can talk about England in a minute, but that's going to present, obviously, a very different challenge. They play a very different style than France. And I think, you know, as I've just kind of gone through the matchup in the last hour in my head, Daniel, there were some individual matchups that could cause the U.S. problems. At the same time, England, much like France, is a country that hasn't won anything. They've gotten the semifinals of major tournaments. And unlike France, who have a lot of players at the club level who've won a lot at Lyon, they have a number of players that have played for Manchester City or Chelsea that have then lost at the club level in the semifinal stage of the Champions League. So eventually those countries get over the hump. We saw that happen with Germany on the men's side after they've been in countless semifinals, and Bayern Munich had lost, two European finals. They finally got over the hump and then they won the World Cup. So maybe this is England's time, but I think the U.S., again, mentally, if you're the opposition, we saw this with France today, Daniel, and you're going up against the United States, you have a sense of fear. The way countries used to have when they went up against Spain in the men's team, and prior to that, against Brazil, I mean, there is that fear, and that's something the U.S. has. That's an intangible that is unquantifiable when you look at individual matchups in a match. So much of this match is between the years. So much of it, this sport is incredible.
Absolutely, and that's the one thing that we have to see is that if you can get through a game like this mentally, that you'll be successful. And just to look at the statistics here in this match, I mean, it's amazing to see that France had the majority of the possession, 60-40 in favor of the France. But, you know, for the U.S., it's like, you know, they didn't, to me, it's like they pressed a lot in this one, and you know they tried to take advantage down the flanks, which they did. They tried to get those crosses in, which they were able to, and they were able to threaten the French all over the place. And even though they let the French have the ball more than they did, And you can see the passing accuracy is 79% for the French, 66% for the U.S. I just think it looks like the U.S. let France have the ball. I mean, passes, it's like the French had at least 173 more passes than the U.S. To me, this reads that they just wanted to press them. They wanted to go down their throats, and they just wanted to put in any ball they could inside the net. And you know what? That's not a bad thing, even though they allowed the French to possess more of the ball.
Yeah, I think you know, it was a classic counterattacking strategy. I think you know France is a very technical side. Look, by the way, Pia Sundage was the manager in 2011, not Jill Ellis, but it was a similar tactic against France, which at the time in 2011, in the World Cup in Germany, some people said, and that was the semifinal, was very defeated because, well, you know, we're the superior country. Who is France? They had just kind of arrived on the women's scene. Now, 8 years later, they have an established playing style. They have won a lot at the club level, these individual players with Lyon and other clubs, PSG also. I think it was more acceptable today to play that way, even though we're the reigning world champions, which we were not in 2011, although we were the reigning Olympic gold medalists. And it worked because I think – so reexamining Ellis' decision to not play Horan and to play Ertz, Mewis, and Lavelle as a three-woman midfield, I think, Daniel, I mean, I guess she got it right. And perhaps I'm biased. We're all biased in some way. And I will admit Lindsay Horan is such a favorite player of mine that I think some people picked up on Twitter when I said, hey, you know, I'm vacationing in Colorado. I'm just getting off the highway, dragging my family an hour out of the way just so I can go through her hometown. You know, because she grew up and played youth soccer. Because I just think she's the first American player we've had in a while that's really good technically, that's really kind of creative. She's not just an athlete or a great finisher like we've had with the Alex Morgan, Gabby Wambach, et cetera, of the world. I mean, she's got that technical skill that we've, you know, with Mia Hamm had. I mean, she plays a different position. But still, so the thing, it was surprising. But I think when you're talking about Ertz and Mewis, you've got that double pivot and that connection working well. And then with Lavelle, you've got a willing runner that's able to kind of close down space if you're going to play defensively. And since we were going to play that way, now we know that, post-match, hindsight's always 20/20, I realize why Horan did not start. However, I will once again point out, when the U.S. presses to relieve pressure, Horan comes in and the link-up play is much better. And from that point on, obviously the U.S. got a second goal. They could have had a third with Heath being maybe a toenail offside. It's an interesting question for the next match, Daniel, against England. What setup do you use? Because England, as I said, play very differently than France. They're probably at times going to concede possession. They're also really kind of lethal and fit. And I think Phil Neville has them set up in a way to where they're going to play a lot of the similar diagonal over the top balls we saw Spain try against the U.S. And it didn't come off that well for the Spanish, although it created a little bit of defensive confusion on the U.S. back line, particularly between on the Salvador Dunn side, on the left side of defense. But England has better players in wide areas. Well, I mean, they've got Lucy Bronze, same with Tony Duggan, right? They've got these great players in wide areas. They also have wingers who, like the French wingers, like to cut inside. Now, that was the thing. France's wingers came inside. The U.S. was able to handle them today. What you will see, though, unless Rapinoe and Heath are so effective going forward, they pin the fullbacks back, is you will see England's fullbacks, particularly Duggan, getting forward on that right side, Paris cutting in, and then, you know, Crystal Dunn and Becky Stahlbrunn having decisions they have to make about things. And that's very different than what we faced with France. Not to say that we, I mean, I want to, you know, celebrate this match, but there's a real challenge coming.
No, absolutely. And, you know, they have to be aware of what's going to be in front of them because this is a semi. You have an opportunity to take on England, and, you know, the English has improved tremendously with Gary Neville as their head coach. And you know what? You know, when you have a guy that has done it all for England, whether it's for the national team or for club teams, I mean, you have to give them credit that he's bringing his knowledge to the women's team over with the Lionesses. I mean, let's be honest here. If you have a man like that, that can sit down, doesn't care what gender his players are, male or female, and he can give his knowledge and his way of, like, how to play football, you know, you have to be very, very wary about who your opponent is going to be next and what they are capable of doing. And I think for the first time, I think for Jill Ellis in two World Cups, she's going to have herself, you know, her hands full here. I mean, she's really going to have to, you know, I don't know. I know she's probably taking a mental break right now. She's probably relaxing right now in the locker room where she's, you know, heading back already on the bus and probably taking an early nap just so she can rest and relax. But if I'm Jill Ellis on the next day, I start scouting. I start watching all those past games that the English have and make sure that she should know very clearly what is in front of her when she takes on the Lionesses and who she's going to put out there in the starting 11, because if something goes wrong, this match is over and done with. So, you know, this is going to be a very interesting semifinal going forward.
I think it's so important to note, and I listen, maybe our listeners don't know this, maybe they do know this, I listen to a lot of the English program, so I'm getting a lot of English media coverage of this tournament. Between 606 and TalkSport and 5 Live, everything. And the thing to me that's become really apparent is Neville, because he had such – and he cites it, you know, a lot of it has to do with his playing career. He was on major tournament rosters for England where they didn't rotate, and some players felt left out. Some players felt like, hey, you know, I got taken to the World Cup. That thing is zero. I'm not playing. Same thing with his experience with Manchester United and Everton. Okay? Squad harmony is so important. So what he's done with the English women is he used the group stage. Now, granted, they have a superior team. They were probably going to win that group, although Japan was in that group, so maybe not. But he decided he was going to play every single field player in the group stage. He was going to rotate his squad. He was going to keep his squad fresh, but he was also going to keep all his girls on side, happy. No one's grumbling in the dressing room, oh, I'm not playing. You know, that happens in every major tournament. We've had problems like that. Well, the English men have had, you know, real problems like that in previous tournaments. The U.S. men have, too. Everybody has. So he's not a really unified team. He's managed his squad well. And then tactically, stylistically, he's kind of transitioned England from – you know, a kind of a kick-and-run philosophy. It's still a little bit of a kick-and-run, but there's a little more creativity in it. And what you see is so many of the players, the bulk of the English team, have played or do play currently for two clubs, Manchester City and Chelsea. And so he's incorporated the tactics from those two clubs. And, in fact, some of the pairings of those two clubs, like Steph Houghton and Lucy Bronze and Nikita Paris have all played together. Club level. So you'll see a lot of nice triangles between them, diagonal balls, a lot of understanding. Millie Bright, Karen Carney, they played together. So there's Fran Kirby played with Millie Bright. So you'll see a lot of that. Now we have our national team plays so many more games than the other top teams that I think we have kind of a club feel with our national team. But of course, in NWSL, a lot of these players play with different teams. I think part of England's sharpness has to do with, and this is a theory, right, about the German men, because so many of them have played for Bayern Munich at one time, or Spain, because so many of them played for Barcelona, that if you don't have 11 starters playing for 11 different clubs, but in England's case, you have of their 11 starters the other night, seven of them, I think eight of them had either played for Manchester City in the last two seasons or played currently for Manchester City. There's a there's a continuity, and that includes, of course, their goalkeeper, Darren Bardsley, who was born in the U.S., but has been Manchester City's goalkeeper in England's number one for a very long time now.
I just want to read this tweet here. It's from Diana Rossini. She works for ESPN, and she is a former soccer player for Georgia Mason University. And her tweet is, "The pressure was always on the U.S. to win this game. To be the best, you have to beat the best. This continued success at the World Cup should have a strong impact on issues of that sort of stuff too." But she wrote something else here. I saw she tweeted something about the pressure, about being in this game and what she wanted to do, to expect the U.S. to play strong in this one. And she did, you know, and they did. I mean, you know, you're taking on the host nation. Very rarely have you seen the United States, whether it's the men or the women, playing against the host nation. The last time I saw that happening was against South Korea, of course, when they went to 2002 World Cup, when it was both shared by the Japanese and the South Koreans. And what happened, plain and simple, is that the United States, well, you know, maybe they should have beaten the South Koreans. They came out of it with a 1-1 draw. So, you know, once again, it's a situation where, you know, you got to take on the host nation in a match like this, where you know you're confident in your ability. At the same time, it could get a little tricky if the host nation does find a way to find that crack in that wall of, you know, what the USA women did right there, and they were able to beat the French, and they take the victory, 2-1.
Yeah, I think there's been you know, kind of a curse on host nations in this Women's World Cup. Obviously, the U.S. won in penalties in 99. Since then, no host nation's been to the final. The other time the U.S. hosted, obviously, we lost in the semifinal to Germany, who went on to win the tournament. In 2007, China got beat in the quarterfinals as the host. 2011, Germany gets beat by Japan, who ends up winning the tournament in the quarterfinals. And then Canada last time losing to England. So now France. It's almost a burden. We haven't seen a host country necessarily excel in a World Cup that they host on the men's side either recently. I mean, South Korea had that matchful run that got them to the semifinals, so they punched above their weight. But that was the last time. Germany, 2006, they get put out by Italy. Obviously, Brazil, we know what happened in 2014. They struggled to get as far as they did, and then once they got there, it wasn't pretty. The game was over within 15 minutes against Germany, if it even took that long. So I think if there's a burden to hosting, and what had happened in this tournament in France is that so many people got into football, women's football, for the first time in France. And it's almost a shame from that standpoint that they're out of the quarterfinal stage. I do think in terms of the match and the U.S. winning now, there are important issues. You know, you talked about that. I don't want to get too political here, but those issues will continue to circulate now over the next couple of days, and issues of equality, et cetera. And in England, Daniel, there has been an incredible amount of interest in this tournament. Now, the problem in England is that they put undue pressure. They have historically always put undue pressure on their men in major tournaments, and their men always fail in major tournaments. Always. Okay, there's no exception. There's no tournament other than this tournament last year, which I think was partly because of the draw they got, but where the English men have met the expectations of the nation, even though, realistically, they probably achieved what they should have achieved. The women have never been under that kind of pressure. And then the first time I heard any hype around the English women was around within the 2017 Euros, and then they got smoked by the Netherlands in the semifinals. This World Cup, it seems like there's an awful lot of coverage. The television ratings on the BBC have been really high. They're getting as many viewers. They're getting almost as many viewers for the England matches there as we're getting for the U.S. matches here. And keep in mind, they have 1/6 the number of people. You know, they have much smaller country. So there's a lot of interest in this team and a lot of pressure building on them. Will they be able to handle it? This is where it helps. And again, I think, you know, by bringing up Devil, you brought up a great issue. What you have in the women's game is a lot of great coaches that have coached in the women's game or have played in the women's game. And even if they're male coaches, they've coached in the women's game. In Neville, you've got a high-level men's player that everyone recognizes who might have a certain edge that the other managers don't have. So I think he's going to keep that squad focused. He's going to keep them loose. And that's going to be a challenge for us. Because as you said, Jill Ellis has gone up against similar managers. She's outboxed them in two World Cups. Didn't do so in the 2016 Summer Olympics. But in the two World Cups she's been in, this might be the most formidable challenge he's faced in an opposing manager. There was a lot of criticism of England hiring Phil Neville because he's a former player. He's a prominent media member. We see him on NBC, right? A lot. His coverage of the Premier League.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he has no coaching experience. How can you hand him the national team? Well, I think the English FA knew what they were doing. They got a prominent former player, everyone respects, and someone who has his own philosophy. Now, he hadn't coached at the club level. It would be an assistant at Valencia for a little bit. But he has his own philosophy, and he's imparted that in these girls, and they're playing for him. Last point about this is I think, when you talk about the way England organizes their back four, Millie Bright, Steph Houghton, Lucy Bronze, you're going to see that space not really open up for the United States. The one thing the United States might be able to do is that back line plays pretty high. So if Rapinoe and Heath can make runs in behind them, you've got an opportunity to get at England. But otherwise, defensively, I don't think they conceded a goal in this tournament, actually, if I think about it, since that game against Scotland, where they looked a little shaky late. But other than that, England has just been flawless defensively in this tournament. And the midfield with players like Frank Kirby has been often bypassed as they build up play and their attack. So this is going to be a very, very, very difficult game. But the expectation around both these squads and what these women are accomplishing is pretty tremendous.
Yeah, it's going to be very tremendous, Cardick, and I really believe that this is an opportunity for the USA women. Of course, we all know how big these World Cup games are, and I just feel that this is probably a bigger opportunity for them to really knock off a very good English side. I mean, without a doubt, they are playing very well. They're firing on all cylinders, and going to be an opponent that cannot be underestimated. As we've already said eloquently, Gary Neville, I mean, look, he is in the media, but he also has his own coaching philosophy. And so far, that philosophy has been spot on. And they have reached the semifinals for the very first time. And let's be honest, they are looking like how he wants them to play. There's no doubt about it. Neville has done a tremendous job with the Lionesses. And I think not the managers were terrible, but at least you can tell that he has a certain way of getting them prepared, ready to go, and they're going to be very, very dangerous on Tuesday afternoon over in the semifinals of this upcoming World Cup. And we'll get more to this, of course, on Monday night, 46 Fire American Soccer Show, 8:15 Eastern Time, 5:15 Pacific. We will preview USA England in the Women's World Cup semifinals. Overall, what's your opinion about this Women's World Cup this year? More surprises than normal?
No, I mean, I think it's been pretty much according to form, other than we've seen the dominance of Europe, Daniel, and that's something we knew that was going to happen. A lot of people have predicted. Japan, with the young squad, turning over so much of their squad, not as strong as always, but they look good. And they're going to be very formidable in Tokyo next summer in the Olympics, and very formidable in the 2023 World Cup. But yeah, pretty much according to form, and I think U.S. England. But we don't want to say that's going to be the final. But I think chances are the winner of the Women's World Cup is going to come out of this match. So looking forward to previewing it with you on Monday evening.
Yeah, I agree. And we'll get more into that semifinal matchup on Monday night. This is going to be a very, very difficult matchup for the USA women. But then again, I would say this has all been difficult. I mean, I think we have to admit that in the game against Spain, I think in post-game, you know, you felt that the Spaniards played better. They were better positionally against the U.S. Here with the French, I just think that early goal by Pino really shook them. You can tell, like, fifth minute, sixth minute, that goal shook the French, and it just put them into a tizzy where they just couldn't get out of it. And even when they did make it 2-1, it just was too little too late. There's no way they're going to come back in that one.
Yeah, I thought the Spain match was more difficult. I mean, but the U.S. is having to run the gauntlet. Spain, France, England, and probably, I mean, it's going to be Germany or the Netherlands in all likelihood. Obviously, there's a whole, Sweden's still alive, Italy's still alive. But you're going to have to run the gauntlet of European powers, Western European powers, especially against Germany, to win this World Cup. Luckily, they won't have to play both Germany and the Netherlands because they're both very formidable. But, job done so far. The Spain game, though, I think was more difficult. Spain set up in a low block. The U.S. wasn't ready for that tactic. They weren't really ready for Spain's physicality. Obviously, I had that family thing I couldn't be on the show on Monday, but my read on that was that the U.S. was very shaky. They were very confused, and quite frankly, now the calls were correct, but quite frankly, got bailed out. Okay, I mean, because neither was a clear goal-scoring threat, but, you know, the Spanish players committed the fouls. I think Jill Ellis knew that the more you kind of control possession against a team with a low block, the more chances there are that you will get a free kick or a penalty. So that tactic ended up paying off, but it was risky, and it could have gone 120 minutes. Spain could have had a penalty at the end of regular time. Now, against France, to be honest with you, I know people are looking at possession statistics and all this and upset at the top of the show. Daniel, I just France's mentality is one of failing at this level. And I saw it from the first kick. There was fear. There was timidity. There was just – I just don't feel like there was any way the U.S. were going to be taken to 120 minutes or lose this match, which is not how I felt against Spain. So I think that match – both matches have toughened the U.S. for this challenge against England. And I think I mentioned it earlier in the show, the one thing that is going to be an issue is England has rotated their squad pretty heavily. That's Neville's philosophy based on his own experiences as a high-level international and his own experiences with Man United. He's probably going to have a fresher team or a fitter team. Now, mentally, we still have an edge. So we'll talk more about this Monday. It's going to be just a tremendous showdown. I think it's going to – there's not much between the two teams. It could go either way.
No, I agree with you there, and it's going to be very interesting to see how this whole thing is going to develop and what the matchups are going to be when you have these two nations fighting for that big World Cup final spot. That'll be coming on Sunday, July the 7th. It should be very interesting to see how that's going to get set up. And or maybe one of them will go to the third place game, and we'll see how that's going to be interesting with the other semifinals. Now, we don't know what's going to happen. Obviously, tomorrow, both quarterfinal games, or the remaining quarterfinal games, will be on tomorrow. So we're going to see what will happen in this Women's World Cup quarterfinals, who will move on to the semis, and then we'll see who will face whom in the big final. So, Kartik, I will talk to you Monday night, this coming Monday night, as we're going to preview that big semifinal matchup. It is, once again, England versus the U.S. in a World Cup semifinal matchup. It's going to be amazing.
Thank you.
Thank you. And for Kartik Krishnire, this is Daniel Feuerstein. Thank you very much for listening to tonight's, this early evening's post-game show, as the United States once again defeats the French by a final of 2-1. They advance to the semifinals of the Women's World Cup, and it's going to be a lot of fun. And then join me, of course, this Sunday night United States hosting Curaçao, or should I say facing Curaçao in the quarterfinals of the 2019 CONCACAF Gold Cup. Join me then. So for Carter Krishnar, World Soccer Talk, this is Daniel Feuerstein. As always, please enjoy your football and join me on Sunday as we will have post-game as the United States will take on Curaçao in the quarterfinals of the 2019 CONCACAF Gold Cup. As always, please enjoy your football. Have a good night. Take care, and bye-bye for now. And I'll be here at Red Bull Arena as MLS gets back on the way for the New York Red Bulls as they're going to take on the Chicago Fire. Have a good afternoon, early evening, everybody.